compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You are invited to participate by calling 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. If you want to send me an email, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on connect and you can send me one. A couple quick ones that just came in. This one comes in from Jean listening in DC. And she says, I just heard you guys talking about dogs and wanted to pass along to you a great nonprofit dog resource where I volunteer called Your Dog's Friend. And that's the website, yourdogsfriend.org. Lots of free resources and webinars that encourage positive reinforcement training and provide info about dog behavior and health, tips and advice for new pet owners, a free webinar library, etc. She says, just thought you or Cyrus might want to take a look. Love your show. Thanks for all you do, Jean. Thank you, Jean. Appreciate that very much. And if you're wondering, if you're just tuning in, why are they talking about dogs? Well, it was just a new study that was done that I shared a little while ago. It was done by The Ohio State University, and they found that the data seems to indicate that neighborhoods where there are more dogs are safer, and crime rates statistically can be shown to be much lower than in neighborhoods that don't have dogs. And they're, you know, obviously they're approaching it with certain parameters. So they're not comparing different kinds of neighborhoods. They're trying to compare the same kind of neighborhoods with the same population density and the same income levels and things like that so that they can get a real sense of it. And they found that, for example, burglaries go down by like 35-40%, homicides go down by like 50% in neighborhoods where you have a lot of dogs. And one of the little details here is that they think that a lot of this is not so much the dog itself, but when they see people out in the neighborhood walking their dogs, that is a deterrent to crime, because those people are going to have eyes on their neighbors' houses and they're going to see, is this, who is that guy? He doesn't belong here. Or where did that car come from? That kind of thing. So if this interests you, as it did to Jean, you can access this article by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. And I appreciate you taking time to write to me, Jean. Thank you. Let's see. Also, I have a message here that came in from Jim listening in Boston. Thank you, Jim. And the heading is Prime Reasons for Shootings. Now, this is far too long for me to be able to read on the show, Jim. So I just want to acknowledge the fact that you wrote it, and he includes a message here from the father of one of the girls who was killed in Columbine, Rachel Scott. And there's a quote from her that is too long for me to be able to read on the air, but I want to acknowledge that. So thank you for that. I will take time to read it carefully, and I'm sure there's some interesting things in there as well. 888-914-9149 is the number. Let's go to Elva now in Los Angeles. Hi, Elva.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is about carrying a concealed weapon. So okay. I live in California, and unfortunately, the laws are really strict with carrying weapons.
Okay.
About a year ago now, I applied for what they call a CCW, a license to carry a concealed weapon. Mm-hmm. And now that my appointment is coming up, I feel a little bit conflicted. So I'm wondering, like, what does the Catholic faith say about just protecting yourself, or, you know, the right to protect yourself?
Yeah, the church has always recognized that you have a right to self-defense. That's part of the natural law, is that you have a right to defend yourself, and if necessary, even with lethal force, if that's the kind of force that's being used against you. It has to be proportionate self-defense. So if somebody's coming at you with a stick, you can't shoot him. You know, you can't meet his force with something greater, because he's not threatening your life. But as a matter of course, you do have the right to self-defense. Now, what about carrying a firearm? Well, the church doesn't say that you can't carry a firearm. That's more a matter of a legal issue. You know, what are the laws of your state? And I realize that California is more stringent in that regard. There are plenty of other states where you don't even have to have a permit. You can open carry.
Right.
And then I think the concealed carries in some states don't even require a permit. Now, to me, that seems kind of reckless. Although I don't think, and I know you didn't ask me this question, but I don't think we should go as strict as Japan is. I was sharing some of the really, really strict measures for gun ownership in Japan. And I'm not proposing that we go down that road or go that far, but I could see being comfortable going somewhat down that road just to make it more, or rather less likely that people would be doing these mass shootings. I don't know if that's a solution for it, but as far as the moral quality of carrying a gun, there's nothing immoral about it. And the church doesn't say you can't do it. You just have to make use of that responsibly and legally, of course.
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, I think that's part of my worry is like, I don't know. It's a confusing issue and it's obviously a big deal. So I just wanted to get your take on it. But thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it so much.
You're most welcome. It is a big deal. That's true. It's a big topic. There's no doubt about it. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Bruce, listening in Lexington, Kentucky. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yes.
You were talking earlier about some of the potential contributors to mass shooting over the years. Mm-hmm. And one of those was, I think you said demonology or thereabouts.
Or demonic influence in some cases.
Demonic influence.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this or not. If you go back and look at some of the tapes, you can see it. Let me relate to you the Parkland shooting. That I don't even remember the kid's name. But after the shooting, he exited along with all the other students, hoping to be, not identified.
Right.
So he was walking through a park, and a sheriff or a deputy approached him, told him to stop because he matched some of the ID. The law enforcement guy said that when he got close to the shooter, he bent over and was vomiting clear, not liquid, but vomiting something clear. My opinion is that it was demons exiting him, because right after that, when the law enforcement approached him, the kid didn't even know that anything had happened. Mm-hmm. And it's my opinion that the demons had total control of his body, and they exited knowing what was going to happen when he was about to go into incarceration. What's your opinion?
Well, that's an interesting.
Go back and look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I'll do that. That's an interesting theory. I don't know whether or not it's true. It could be true, but think about this for a minute. Why would a demon care whether or not the subject, the person that the demon is possessing, if indeed that's what happened? Why would he care one way or the other if that guy is in jail? It's not as though there's some danger to the demon. You know, it's not as though the police are going to be able to find, uh-oh, you got a demon in you. There'd be no reason for the demon to exit this person that he had gone to all this trouble to possess in the first place. Remember when Jesus in the Gospels, Bruce, would cast out demons? There are some instances where we're told that the demons were sort of pleading with Jesus not to cast them out because they want to be inside the person who's demonically possessed. And then there's one very dramatic situation where they beg Jesus to send them into a herd of swine because they want to be inside of something. And I guess a pig is better than nothing. And of course, the pigs go into a frenzy, they go over the cliff, and they all drown. So those biblical incidents suggest to me that whatever it was that you see on the tape, which I haven't seen, is probably not a demon exiting the body of the guy, if indeed he is possessed, and we don't know if he is. But if he were possessed, I don't see why the demon would want to leave. I don't see any motivation for that. You see what I'm saying?
I don't have an answer for that either. I'm familiar with, the demons pleading with Jesus to be cast into the swine, it's one of those three-dimensional versus 13-dimensional things, which we'll never understand, I guess. But please go back and look at that, and you'll find that I'm correct.
Well, I don't doubt that. I'm not disputing the veracity of what you're saying. But here's another thing to try on for size. In demonology, and I'm not by any stretch whatsoever an expert or even close to an expert in that, there are people who are. But in reading things like the writings of the exorcists, Father Gabriel Amorth, for example, he's one of a number who have written books. One of the things that they talk about here and there is how the body of the possessed person can produce really bizarre and large quantities of strange things like nails. So, for example, you might vomit up a pound of nails or glass or shards of metal or other things, toads. I've heard of that kind of thing, where other strange things that should not be inside your body are being belched out. And that, of course, that's super preternatural. It could be that maybe what you see on the video, if indeed the man was possessed, that you're seeing something along those lines. I don't know. I'm just suggesting that that may be another thing. I'll recommend to you, Bruce, if you're interested, there's a book by Jesse Romero. It's called The Devil in the City of Angels. And I recommend it. I have a copy of it. And the backdrop to this book is that Jesse Romero was in law enforcement in Southern California. He was LA County Sheriff. And he might even have been, he might have done a stint with the LAPD. I don't remember for sure. But this book is a series of instances of his own law enforcement contact with people who were possessed. And maybe the most notable of them was Richard Ramirez, who was known as the Night Stalker. He was the guy who was breaking into people's homes and killing them. I think it was in the 1980s. So he had a direct encounter with that guy. So if you're interested, that might be another thing to take a look at. Again, the book is called The Devil in the City of Angels. Thanks for the call. Very interesting stuff. How about Jennifer now in Milwaukee? Hi, Jennifer.
Hello, how are you?
Hi there. I am well, thanks.
Okay. I'm calling you today. It's not like this is a story you haven't heard a million times. My youngest daughter, she just turned 26 years old. She mm-hmm. went to 13 years of Catholic school. We always went to Mass on Sunday. She got her communion, penance, confirmation, the whole thing. And then I sent her off to college. And we all know what happens then. So she came back different and really was not going to church or anything. While she was in college, she met a young man, and they've been dating for about 6 years. She moved in with a girlfriend, and then last year, he moved in with the girls. So they've been living together for about a year. Mm-hmm. She's just a really sweet girl, but I think she's chasing what the, you know, spirit of the age is. You know, she was involved with BLM, and she thinks she's terrible because she's a white person, all this stuff. But she asked me recently, too. She said, I've asked her before if she believes in God, and she says, yes, of course. And then we were talking about something, and she said, well, Mom, doesn't everybody go to heaven? So I said, well, no, not everybody goes. Mm-hmm. So last night, I'm coming to the big thing here. Okay. I got a text from her boyfriend, and he asked me what I was doing Sunday, and I said, well, I'll be home after Mass. And he said, what, and blah, blah. He said, well, what if I come over at 2? And this is not usual of him.
If you could, just in the interest of time, if you could summarize what happened, that would be helpful.
Well, he's going to, he's going to ask her to marry him.
Okay.
And with him being here Sunday, I'm wondering how I put it out there that my expectation or the right thing to do is to be married in the church without, you know, it's going to be sticky, but I thought maybe talking to him about it and then him taking it home to her.
What is his religious background, if he has any?
He's a Lutheran, but I don't think he's ever been to his church. I don't know when. Years back, he said he wanted to become a Catholic, and I said, well, I'll be your sponsor, but he never pursued it.
Why don't you do this, Jennifer? Why don't you say, sure, we'll get together on Sunday after Mass. So join us at, you know, 10 minutes to 9 a.m. at St. Miscellaneous Parish. We'll go to Mass together, and then after Mass, we'll go get brunch, and we'll talk. And include going to Mass as part of that. And it seems like that would be a nice way to set the stage for the message you want to give him, either then or at some point down the road. And that is, you know, we're Catholic. This is a Catholic family. Our daughter was raised Catholic. And, you know, we want this wedding to be in the Catholic Church. And, you know, obviously you can show respect, et cetera, but you make it known that this is something that's important to you and to your husband and to your family and at large. And that way he, in a way, it's kind of like assuming the sale in sales. If there's a certain verbiage you can use with a potential client that assumes the sale and kind of subliminally implants in the mind of the person you're trying to sell the thing to, well, yeah, of course I'm going to buy this. And you can do something similar in this regard, and maybe that will be the way to get them to get married in the Catholic Church.
Because I'm not allowed to attend the church then if it's not right.
Well, let's burn that bridge when we get to it. But I'd say in the meantime, you've got some runway here, sounds like, and you've got an opportunity to build some kind of rapport with him, to build some kind of friendship, even if possible. And then it's not being exploitative. It's not like you're doing this for duplicitous motives. But if you can have a good relationship with this young man, then he's more, I think, going to be more amenable to your suggestion that they get married in the church. And you can, you can do it.
I hope so.
Yeah, just give it a try.
I'm just worried about which way it's going to go, so. But
I know. Well, you can die of worry. And most of the things that we worry about, my wife tells me this all the time because I tend to worry. All the things you tend to worry about, or most of them anyway, tend not to happen. You know, it's all those what-ifs that keep you up at night, and they never really happen, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jennifer.
I think this will help.
I hope so. And while you're at it, maybe you can give a gift to each of them. Give her a copy of Steve Wood's book called The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband, and give him the book also by Steve Wood, The ABCs of Finding a Good Wife. They're two different books with two different messages, but they dovetail, as you can imagine. And they're really good advice. And I think it will help clarify their thinking. The church discourages mixed marriages, by the way. And so this is not something that is ideal. Doesn't mean it's impossible, but it's not ideal. And the church doesn't prefer that Catholics enter into mixed marriages. But if you give each of them a copy of these two books, I have a feeling that it's going to help clarify their thinking, and it may make things easier. I hope they will. Thanks, Jennifer. I'll be right back with more of hour two of our three-hour program right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Let's go to Maria in Cherry Valley, New York. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning. I have a good question.
Okay.
My sister in California asked me to call you. She's listened to you for a long time. But here's the thing. The first Saturdays of the month, you're supposed to do five devoted to the Virgin Mary. Now, I've done three so far, but my sister and I disagree.
Okay.
I listen every morning, except Thursday when I go to a senior club meeting. So that Saturday, I watched Mass and also Spiritual Communion. Later the same day, which is the first Saturday, the third one I'm doing now, I went to church, Catholic Church, and I went to Mass. But before Mass, I said the rosary, and I also went to confession, and I received Holy Communion. Mm-hmm. And she's telling me that does not count, that that is really supposed to be for Sunday, which is not Saturday. Now, what do you think?
Okay. Well, this much I know, that when Sister Lucia conveyed this request by Our Lady, from Our Lady of Fatima's apparitions, she said that these active reparations would take the following form. So you go to confession any time within 8 days before or after the first Saturday, to receive Holy Communion any time within 24 hours of the first Saturday. It can be Sunday, it could be Friday, it could be Saturday. To pray 5 decades of the Rosary, and to meditate prayerfully upon whatever the mysteries of the Holy Rosary are that you're praying for 15 minutes. And those are the requirements for making the first Saturday's devotion. And you'll notice that there is no requirement that it has to be done, at least in terms of confession, for example, on that particular day. So that's the heart of the that's the heart of the devotion. Now, I don't remember exactly which of you that go ahead.
So I'm right when I said at the same Saturday, which was the first Saturday of the month, mm-hmm. I did both. I went to Mass twice. I went to spiritual communion as well as regular communion. I also went to confession, all mm-hmm. on that one Saturday.
Yeah, well, you certainly can do that. Yeah, there's no question. You can do all of those things on Saturday. But the requirement allows for you to do it, say in the case of Holy Communion, 24 hours before or after the first Saturday. And the same is true for confession. That could be any time within 8 days. They call that the octave. So within 8 days.
I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe you're both right.
Then,
when you think about
that
it.
Means it counts. That means it counts.
Oh, yeah. See, this is the thing to remember. And thank you for the call, Maria. It's not like Our Lady's, or God, for that matter, is going to say, oh, sorry. Sorry, Maria. That doesn't count. You didn't do it right. You didn't, you know, you're 1 hour over the edge. That's not how God works. And that's not the purpose of the devotion. The purpose of the devotion, it has certain parameters, but the spirit of the devotion is what's mostly important. Otherwise, it just becomes perfunctory. It just becomes almost mechanical. Where if I do this, this, and this in this order at this time and stand on my left leg, you know, then it's got to happen. No, that's not how God works. It's something that's done in faith and in trust. So I don't think there's anything for you or your sister to worry about. I think you're both right when you think of it. Thank you. I hope that's helpful to you. Let's go back to Elizabeth, see if we can get to Elizabeth in Austin. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Yes.
Hi there.
Hi. My son. Good morning. My son is 27, and so is his fiance. Of course, he's a cradle Catholic. And she came into the church in 2017, I think, when she was in high school. Her family, they all came into the church. They are engaged, and they are planning an October wedding. The first thing they did was go to the church. There was just no question on whether that was going to happen.
Okay.
And they, going through their classes, they're almost done. They were told by the parish that they needed to donate $1,000 to have a wedding in the church. Now, these are two young people that are actually paying for their marriage on their own. They're actually getting married on a Thursday so they can afford a nice wedding. And they're both Army veterans. You know, they're trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. As far as their life when they came home, very disappointed on that. So they can't afford that. So they're looking at the venue where they're having their reception to have a secular wedding there mm-hmm. first and then get married in the church. I'm very sad about that. And so is my son. He realizes that that this is not something that should happen. I explained to him, you know, of course we have to pay to keep the lights on, but, you know, to ask for that kind of a donation or demand it for a sacrament.
Are they parishioners at that parish?
So,
They are.
Mm-hmm. She came into the church there. Yes, sir. And we are parishioners there. He's a parishioner. They're parishioners there.
That does seem, it seems rapacious to, especially if you're a parishioner and you're subsidizing the parish with your donations each week, to demand $1,000 just to be able to receive the sacrament of holy matrimony in the parish church. That does seem rapacious to me. Did you say then that you took this up with the pastor and that was the answer you got?
You know, Patrick, no, because, my son has always been his own man. And so when I suggested he go to the diocese and have some explanation about this, or he said that he would do that. And he's so sweet. He was trying to think of a Bible verse. He was trying to come at it, in an honest, honest way. So, no, I have not. And the reason I have a little inkling on that because I've listened to you for many, many years. No, sir, I have not spoke to them.
That might be the next thing to do.
The diocese.
Yeah, well, I would suggest that your son, talk to the pastor and say, I don't understand this. I mean, if you said, if that fee is inclusive of there's going to be a string quartet and an organist and ushers and security and a whole bunch of things that the parish requires, and maybe even an insurance policy on top of that, okay, maybe there's some room to see that, but it still seems exorbitant. $1,000 seems quite exorbitant to me. So if he were to talk to the parish priest first, maybe he can get some relief there, because obviously the parish priest, the pastor, is going to be the decision maker. But if he doesn't...
Sir. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, if he doesn't get anywhere there, my sense of it is... Yeah, I mean, he certainly could go to the bishop, no doubt about it. But I have a feeling the bishop's going to say, well, it's up to the pastor to set the policy for things like that. And then you're faced with a situation. Okay. Well, what if, let's just play this out, Elizabeth. What if the scenario happens that the bishop phones up Father McGillicuddy and says, Father McGillicuddy, don't charge him $1,000. Don't do that. Well, now, now... I can easily imagine where he may be really unhappy that they're going to have this wedding there. I don't know. It just seems like the easiest way to handle it, if possible, would be with the priest himself and see if you can get any.
Got it. Yes, sir.
Anywhere there.
The first line of defense. Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
The other. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Okay, good. And so is there any words that you can offer maybe to help him, articulate better?
Maybe to say along these lines, Elizabeth, just, we're registered parishioners here. We donate monthly or weekly, whatever it is. We support the parish. And this is our parish, and we want to receive the sacrament of holy matrimony here. And it's unreasonable and it's exorbitant to charge $1,000 just for the privilege of receiving a sacrament in our church. It smacks of simony. Now, simony is trafficking in holy things, trying to sell, for example, sacraments. It's deeply wrong, and the church forbids it. It's a serious sin. And this kind of comes across like simony. It's like you're charging us $1,000 to be able to receive a sacrament here, and that's not appropriate. So what can we do to make this work, Father? Can you get around this? Is it possible, if you're the decision maker, can you waive this, et cetera, et cetera? Just kind of put it out there. Be really matter of fact, and have a feeling, if you say your son's a very forthright guy, that seems like the best way to go about doing it. Now, who knows what the reaction might be? The reaction might be indignation on the part of the priest, or I don't know. It's hard to know what to suggest, but it seems like it's worth pushing back against in a respectful way and see what happens.
I believe so. I believe so. And then the alternative is they move to a small town, up the highway about 30 miles, and there's a little parish there. The parish that they initially looked at is a giant parish. So perhaps this was an alternative. And this came from them, not me. I didn't say, hey, why don't you try that? So, yes, we are trying to do the right thing. Okay, well, I appreciate your time on that and your the words. Thank you.
And may they have many happy years together, please God. Let's go now to Alex in San Diego. Hello, Alex.
Good morning, Patrick. Let me get you off speakerphone.
That would be great.
Thank you. Okay, good morning. So I have a myriad of questions, but the two that I want to ask, and you can choose based on time if you have time for the second one. Sorry, I was warming up my day. First one is, I've been a catechist both for First Communion and Confirmation, and through the participating after COVID and the traditional Mass, you know, I just became more aware of the laxity of the, well, basically the lack of program that I had for, or training that I had for it, especially for confirmation. And so the question is, what's a good, if I went back to the same parish, which I'm not attending, and they offered me to which they did, I was, they asked me to, if I could help out, and I see the necessity. I think there's a lack of people that would like to help with that. And then
Alex, I'm starting to lose the track. I'm losing the track of where we're going. I'm not sure what you're asking me.
What is the best way to self teach myself, you know, to just try to, you know, if I'm not being mandated, you know,
you mean to learn the program, learn the faith, or to be able to teach it?
To be able to teach it. For the first program, I can tell you we participated in what's called a catechesis familiar, which was great. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a book to follow, and I loved it because I didn't have much room to put up my own, you know, to relish it with my own thoughts or whatever. But for confirmation, I basically was, you know, was just thrown in there. There was a requirement which was not really enforced, and I felt really inadequate. You know, I did my best, but I still want to pursue that path of being able to catechize.
Yeah,
if I'm allowed the possibility again.
Yeah, I think I can recommend something that will help you. If you wanted to, you could enroll in a catechetical certificate program. And one example that I'm very familiar with is offered by Holy Apostles College and Seminary. Now, full disclosure, I teach as an adjunct professor at Holy Apostles College and Seminary in their online department. They have a full campus, but I teach in the online department. But they have a certificate program that you can enroll in, and it would be entirely online. And it would certify you as an accredited catechist. And so all of
this... Holy Apostles what?
It's Holy Apostles College and Seminary, and their website is holyapostles.edu.
Okay.
So here's what you do. What you do. Go to holyapostles.edu, and you want to go to their certificate programs, and there you'll find they offer graduate certificates, and they have one in Catholic Pastoral Counseling. They have one in youth and young adult ministry, and they have one in Christian wisdom. They have certificates in family studies, counseling, spiritual direction, adult ministry, catechetical ministry, which is more what you're interested in, and apologetics. And so that would be a systematic. Now, this is, you know, one school that I'm very familiar with, and I can vouch for the quality of their content. There are others who have similar programs, but I would suggest you take a look here first.
Okay, so I should select the catechetical ministries for my purpose of my question today.
I think so. In other words, if I hear you correctly, and what you're saying is you don't feel adequately prepared to teach the courses, this is one way that you could make sure that you're adequately prepared and that you really know the material. And that'd be a nice thing on your resume. It'd be something that you could be proud of.
Yeah. Okay. And hopefully, if you have the time, the second question I had was what happened to this, you know, the demonic spirits, you know, that went into the herd of swines once Jesus commanded them to.
They went back out.
To go in them.
Yeah, they went back out.
Well, yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out. If they went back into the world to roam and try to find another living creature, you know, to right. go back into, or
seems that way, yeah. So once the swine became agitated and they went over the cliff and drowned, there was nothing for the demons to do there anymore. So they left those bodies, and yeah, they were wandering around. You know, who knows what they were doing? Only God knows. But they were no longer in those swine. Well, anyway, I've got to run, but I'm glad we had a chance to talk about that. Holyapostles.edu is the website for their certificate programs. And while you're there, if you want to check out my apologetics course, go to holyapostles.edu/Patrick, and you'll find information on how to enroll in my course. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Compelling insights.
Yes, we've been waiting for a long, long time.
Unpredictable conversations.
We've been waiting for a long time.
Encouragement for your day.
We ain't gonna wait no more. We're getting ready to rock and roll.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
If you want to send me an email, just go to the show page. Go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on connect and you can send me an email. And boy, do I get them. I get 40, 50 a day. It makes me know that you're out there listening. I really appreciate it. Here's one that came in from Chris. And Chris says, she's listening in Northern California. She says, I'm very familiar with confession now, including an examination of conscience, as I read many Catholic books about it, and then resources in the Relevant Radio app. And then I also realized many, many more venial sins were in some cases mortal sins that I was not even sure, that I was not even aware were sins. So I have a very, very long list now to confess, including a bunch from 2 months ago that the priest kind of rushed me and cut me off when I was giving him my list, which has grown since then. I really don't want to make an appointment with a priest. And this is a woman, by the way. She says, I really don't want to make an appointment with a priest. Privacy. I want to do the walk-in. I'm going to try a different church, but I'm just having anxiety that they're also going to cut me off with my long list of sins. I don't plan on discussing anything with the priest unless, of course, he wants to discuss something with me. I just want to read him the list of my sins, which is very, very, very long, going back to the 1980s. One church said, it's okay, just bring your list. I hope they don't have short-term amnesia. All right, well, Chris, first of all, two thumbs up and a snap of the fingers for you, because this is a great sign that you are growing in your Christian maturity and the sensitivity of your conscience is increasing, and you are becoming more aware of the reality of things going on in your life that are indeed sinful. And that's a good thing. It'd be like knowing that there were some aches and pains in your body, but never really knowing what was causing them. And then you go in and you get a blood test and you get examined by the physician and you take x-rays and you do all the diagnostics. And then you find out what's causing those aches and pains so that you can fix them. That's what you're doing, which is really good. So I'm really happy to hear that this is happening in your life. And I can understand how it would be frustrating. And this has happened to me before, but I can understand why, if you're trying to talk about your sins and you're not being long-winded, you're not, you know, taking up time that people who are waiting in line behind you really need to get to confession. You're just trying to get through your list of sins. Well, it's really deeply, deeply unfortunate that a priest would rush you. You know, obviously, if the priest says, you know, I've got to celebrate Mass in 5 minutes, that's different. That's different. But if confessions are being held on Saturday afternoon from, say, 4 to 6 or from 3 to 5 or whatever it is, and you're not anywhere near Mass, in charity at the very least, and if he's actually the pastor of the parish or if he's an associate pastor, also in justice, there is a duty on that priest's part to adequately hear your sin, hear your confession. So there's a balancing act here. It doesn't sound to me like you are that you're taking up too much time needlessly. So what I would do is get to confession early so that you can be one of the first in line. And then when you go into the confessional, say, Father, please understand, I'm not going to talk your arm off. I'm not going to go into unnecessary detail. I'm not looking for spiritual direction, but I have a somewhat lengthy list of sins, and I would appreciate if you could just let me say all of them. Because last time when I went to confession at St. Miscellaneous Parish, the priest rushed me and I wasn't able to finish telling him my sins. And I have got some sins I really need to tell you about. And he'll understand. I'm sure he will. So if you let him know right up front, please, I got rushed last time. I would really appreciate it if I could just have enough time to say all this. And I would say, tell him right up front, I'm not going to seek spiritual direction. I only need the time necessary to read the list of my sins. And I'm certain he's going to say, okay, understood, go. So that's what I would do. And just as we have had with other callers, if you can't find, you know, if you don't get an adequate response in a given parish, something's not working that should, then you're free to go to a different parish if you want to. You don't have to go to confession face-to-face. You have that right to be anonymous. The church desires that you have no barriers between you and the sacrament of confession. And so that would be my advice. But I really want to encourage you and tell you how happy I am for you that you're moving in this direction, because it means that you're becoming clearer and more sensitive to these issues. Thank you. And let's go now to Joseph in Lindale, Texas. Hi, Joseph.
Hello, Patrick. So I had a pretty simple question. We'll see if it's simple. But anyways, I was wondering what the church's stance is on artificial insemination in farm animals. I know that dairy farmers often do this, and I just wanted to hear.
There's no opposition whatsoever, because there's no moral value one way or the other to whether it's natural insemination or artificial insemination. Because they're not persons. Animals are not persons. They can't make moral acts. Now, if your question is it moral or immoral for the human who's doing the artificial insemination? It's entirely moral. It's really in a sense amoral. It's not immoral because it's not anything wrong. It's not moral because he's not doing something that's somehow intrinsically good. It's just sort of neutral, morally neutral.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. If only all the questions were that simple, and the answers too, for that matter. Thanks, Joseph. Let's go now to Darman in Concord, California. Hi, Darman.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Okay. Yay, it's like my spiritual dad. I'm so happy to talk to you. I've been wanting to ask you this question for so long. At the Last Supper, when Jesus says, I've earnestly desired to celebrate this Passover with you.
Mm-hmm.
So they're celebrating Passover, right? And weren't the disciples, because they didn't fully understand that he was getting ready to be crucified, is my understanding. So weren't they a little confused on, wouldn't they have been confused on why there wasn't a lamb there?
Well, so you're talking about what was the food on the table at the Last Supper? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Wouldn't they have questioned, you know, when he said, go prepare the Passover for me?
Right. Yeah, you know what's interesting is that Scott Hahn wrote a book on this very topic. It's called The Lamb's Supper. And if you're interested in kind of going deep into what happened at the Last Supper and what was the food, and what does it mean that he said, I will not drink the fruit of the vine with you until the kingdom, until we enter in the kingdom? Mm-hmm. So all these things are covered. But my understanding is that because Jesus himself, as St. John the Baptist said, is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, at the part of the supper where we have the narrative of what Jesus said, that he, in a way that's maybe not necessarily told to us in any explicit way in Scripture, he revealed to them or showed them or told them that he is the Lamb of sacrifice. And when he talked about, this is my body which will be given up for you, my blood which will be poured out for you and for many, these are the things that he was about to undergo the following day on Good Friday. So in a strict sense, there was no need for a sacrificial lamb to be broiled the way the Passover meal was celebrated, because he himself was the lamb, and he was giving the apostles himself in the act of celebrating that first Mass, giving them the bread of life. Does that answer your question, or am I missing the mark here?
No, it does. It does. But it seems like, so the Bible doesn't explicitly, it just seems like looking, like we can see that clearly now looking at it, but you know, it seems like they might have been like, okay, we're celebrating the Passover, but where is the lamb? You know, but I guess he made it clear to them.
Yeah, see, that part, what's interesting, if you look at Luke chapter 22 or the other passages where we see the Last Supper told to us, we don't see any explicit statement about the lamb. We don't see Jesus saying that. So that's why I think, and this is where a Bible scholar like Scott Hahn, I am not a Bible scholar, but he is, and he has some deep insights into this. That's where a book like Scott Hahn's book, The Lamb's Supper, can help you a lot to go deeper. But I think it's sufficient to say that although there is no explicit statement about the lamb, it talks about the bread and the wine. It talks about a dish with some liquid in it that they were dipping food into. That was a custom to, you know, you'd wet your food before you put it in your mouth. It doesn't say anything about a lamb one way or the other. So from a theological point, we could at least surmise that there was no need for the lamb because this was the Lamb of God. And so to have an animal, have to be eating an animal lamb would be superfluous, which is not to say that maybe there wasn't some lamb there. I mean, I'm not saying that I know that there was no lamb. All I'm saying is that the biblical narrative suggests to us that Jesus showed them by his actions and his words that he himself was the Lamb of God.
True. I didn't even think of that. I mean, maybe there was a lamb there. Interesting. Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah.
I love your show.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I appreciate that. And I just want to underscore the point I just made. I'm proficient to the extent that I'm proficient in Scripture, but that's different. That's not the same thing as being a Scripture scholar. I am not a Scripture scholar. But I have a lot of regard for those who are. And this is why their books, after lots of deep research and consulting commentaries in the church fathers and things of that nature, those can be extremely helpful to you in your effort to participate more fully in the Mass and get more out of the sacramental life of the church. So avail yourself, if at all possible, of reading some of these books. It's only going to help you. Of course, keep listening to the Patrick Madrid Show, because you know that's what I do too. I have to learn from the experts and I have to keep up. And I do try very hard to keep up and lots of reading and research and preparation before I even get on the microphone. And those are some of my go-to sources as well, so I can learn from the experts, as they say. 888-914-9149. I've got some more emails and more of your phone calls. Hour 3 is about to start. Speaking of emails, if you want to send me one, just go over to relevantradio.com/Patrick and click on the contact button. You'll see it there right below where it says The Patrick Madrid Show. Click on that and you'll be able to send me an email. And please know that it comes directly to me. I do read them all. I have quite a few that are there. So it's not a fast process, but it does happen and I do read them. So please, by all means, feel free to send me an email. Good, bad, or indifferent, I'll be on the lookout for it.